Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Flags in Boston are at half staff today, honoring the death of former Mayor Tom Menino. And that's where we'll begin our week in review today.
I never dreamed I would end up here. Mayor of Boston, during its best years.
Also this week, with the election just days away, the candidates for governor are making their final pitches to voters, and the talk has been about taxes, ethics, and a fishy tale of tears.
The question we got asked was, when was the last time you cried? And I told this story.
Don't start now.
I won't start now.
Plus, back home in Maine, after treating Ebola patients in West Africa, Nurse Casey Hickox defies a quarantine.
I am not going to sit around and be bullied by politicians and forced to stay in my home when I am not a risk to the American public.
And joining us now to talk about these stories in our week in review panel, John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and the blogger behind Campaigner Outsider. Hello, John.
Hello, Anthony.
Happy Friday. Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Tom Keene, always great to have you.
Thanks. Happy Halloween. Pleasure to be here.
So we're going to start off with the passing of Tom Menino, the city's longest-serving mayor, who died yesterday, of course, at the age of 71. Here's the mayor reflecting on a life spent in public service.
I never did anything special. I just did what I thought was right. I came up from Hyde Park Avenue. There's gangs all over the place, and I was victim of some of them. I knew what it was all about. I just wanted to be there for him. That's probably who Tom Menino is. Nothing special, nothing fancy. It was not a fancy guy, that's for sure. But whatever I did, I thought was the right thing for the young people, for the adults, for the business community. When you take the oath as mayor, you're mayor of all the people. And how do you improve all their lives, not just some of their lives?
So, Tom Keene, you worked with the mayor. You were on the city council 1994 to 1999 when he was mayor. I'd love to know your thoughts today about this week.
So I really remember very distinctly when he came into office and kind of the agenda setting that was going on at that point. And the agenda setting was really trying to restore Boston. It was a city that, prior to that, a lot of people thought was on its way down. And in particular, it was one that was losing its middle-income population, middle-class population. Menino very much had this focus on trying to restore Boston as a residential city. And it kind of earned him, from Mike Barnicle, the nickname of the urban mechanic. But the way he did it is he started with the small stuff. He sweated the small stuff and thought that if you sweat the small stuff, the big stuff takes care of itself.
I'd love to ask you about this. And Sasha and I were talking with a number of people yesterday about this very issue. He was a stunningly effective politician. And I'm just curious to get a perspective from another city politician who probably saw him up close and appreciated him up close about how effective he was and how he did that.
So Tom Menino, I mean, we're having a lot of, fond remembrances about him right now and in a little bit of myth-making right now, I think. But the reality is that Menino was amazingly effective at understanding power and wielding power. Mm-hmm. And that's what made him so good as a politician. And sometimes I think we're very uncomfortable with the notion that people actually have power. But we hand them that power, and if they use it effectively, they can accomplish great things. I would compare the guy, say, to Lyndon Baines Johnson getting through the civil rights legislation, something Kennedy couldn't do. But Johnson understood how to use the levers of power to accomplish something. Menino really had that same kind of talent. And I would add to that he also had the talent, or he had the ability, to really connect very closely with the residents in the city. And as a consequence, he really knew what people were thinking. He knew how far he could push and when he had to pull back.
Mm. And John Carroll, let me come to you. The city we live in today, so much of it defined by Tom Menino. What's your take on his legacy? Or on some of the myth-making that Tom was referring to there.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, the city is completely different from when he became mayor 20 years ago. And a lot of it had to do with him. A lot of it didn't have to do with him. The infrastructure obviously had a lot to Mayor Menino had a lot to do with. The demographics, I'm not sure he does have a lot to do with. And those are very different from when he started. I was thinking about when how he campaigned for mayor. He ran five times, and I thought back to 1993, and this past election was the first open mayoral election in 20 years. And I went back to the archives and pulled out all the advertising, the TV advertising from the 93 race, and I had everything from the prelim, from the general, except I didn't have Tom Menino's ads because Tom Menino wouldn't give me his ads. And this was early on, so before he found out how annoying I was, he was all about control. He was all about control. And campaigning, he had this tendency not to engage. He had this tendency, the famous quote from Jack Nicholson when they were making Batman with Michael Keaton. You know, Michael Keaton's agonizing, and Jack Nicholson says, "Let the costume do the acting." And and in a way, Tom Menino let That's the office line. Do the campaigning. Yeah. He would go about his business and really not engage with his competitors. And it made for an interesting dynamic, but it also made for Boston to feel a little bit like Mayberry for those 20 years.
You know, John and Tom, on the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings, I had done a story about the young married couple, Jessica Kensky and Patrick Downs, who each lost a leg. And I happened to see them last week, and they got in touch with me today to just say they felt really devastated about having lost Menino. They were talking about at that one-year anniversary, he made that powerful speech at the podium, and he said, "When the lights dim and the cameras go away, know that our support and love for you will never waver." And what Jessica said was that she considered him their surrogate grandfather, which I thought was very powerful. And despite the savvy politician he was, he still had people think of him that way, as surrogate grandfather. I think that says a lot about the effect he had on regular people, if there's such a thing as a regular person.
Yeah, he had this duality. I mean, it was like he was twins in one body. He could be empowering and controlling. He could be gracious. He could be vindictive. But he had this connection with people that that was real and that people really felt. And when you look at the sort of the outpouring now from the citizens of Boston, there is a real personal connection that he had that not that many politicians actually manage.
One of the biggest pieces of unfinished business, even in Menino's own telling, was his management of the Boston public school system. We have a piece of tape of the mayor speaking in his office at City Hall near the end of his term. And when he was asked about his greatest regret, he said that without a doubt, it was the schools.
We've made a lot of progress. More kids going out to college, lower dropout rate, all those things. But still, we haven't achieved our ultimate goal, every kid achieving. We take all the kids, special needs kids, English learners. We try to educate every one of those children. Some of those other schools that brag about 100% graduation rate and all that stuff, they don't take those kids. Every kid walks through the door, I educate. That's my challenge.
Tom, I want to point out that he just said, "I educate." I think that tells us a lot about what Tom Menino felt about his role in the city.
My city.
Exactly.
So Tom Menino was an incrementalist. I mean, he was not someone who's really prone to going into big leaps. He really did build up the power. And there were many people, including myself, who really would have loved to see him take the power that he had, the authority that he had, and take a risk in terms of really transforming the schools. He did not. I think looking back on it, he's somewhat regretting it, because while the incrementalism was helpful in terms of stabilizing the schools, and he really had two superintendents who were there for a long period of time versus before when we seemed to just have, you know, round robin of superintendents, the improvements were just marginal.
Do you think he took risks in other areas but not in the education realm?
I think in other areas he didn't have to take the risks. The things weren't sort of fundamentally broken. The one place I thought that maybe he did take a risk was in terms of policing, and when he brought in community policing. And he really had a new style of policing with his police commissioner at the time. That might have been a risk, but it played out very well for him.
John Carroll, do you have any thoughts about Menino's unfinished business?
Well, I think the public schools are a big part of the unfinished business. And I think that he said to everyone, the citizens of Boston, to the media, "Judge me harshly on how I do with the schools." And then didn't really seem to want to be judged harshly on how he did with the schools. And no question, it was a big mountain to climb. I mean, he inherited a school system that was troubled at its very core, and got more and more difficult to deal with as the demographics changed in the city of Boston. But again, I mean, this was something that needed more attention, more focus, and more progress. And he didn't make it. I'm not sure who could have made it, but I think he had a long time to work on it.
Yeah. Well, a moment ago, we heard Martha Coakley saying that if Menino would want the candidates for governor to get back to the business of campaigning and winning a race. So we're going to move on to the race for governor now. And voters go to the polls in just 4 days. The polls show that the race is in a dead heat, if not tilting a bit toward Charlie Baker. But all the chatter this week has been about this moment from the televised debate on Tuesday night. Asked about the last time he cried, Baker told of a meeting a fisherman from New Bedford who told his sons to stay in the family business rather than go to college.
I said, "You're going to be fishermen." I was a fisherman. My brothers were fishermen. My father was a fisherman. "You're going to be fishermen." And I ruined their lives.
We've played that tape maybe too much this week. But it turns out the story is one that Baker's been telling since 2009. Reporters have been looking for the fisherman, haven't found anyone that matches the one that Baker's describing. And the candidate said yesterday that he might have gotten some details wrong. Tom, what do you make of this? And if there's fallout from this, I'd love to know your take.
Well, of course, I think we should never have elected Ed Muskie because he cried in the snow. I mean, and this does kind of go back to that. And I actually, what really struck me about it is in the debate, it's like, well, okay, that's a touching moment. I had no idea at the time there would be this kind of fallout. Mm. I actually thought we were sort of beyond 1968 at this point. But apparently we're really not beyond 1968. And it is, for both sexes, by the way, crying is an issue. It's a different issue, and it plays out differently for each one. But it is fascinating to see how this has dominated the conversation.
And what do you think of that? Because it's interesting that you brought up Muskie in 1968, because, of course, back then there was evidence that he might have been tearing up, and it contributed to his campaign going down. Now it seems like politicians are being told to please cry. We need you to cry. When the last time you cried? And we need you to cry.
Right. I mean, you know. You can argue that this shows, oh, Charlie Baker is a Republican and a numbers guy and a management guy, really does have a heart, and that's what this shows you. I have to tell you, I just do not think any voter should make a decision based upon this moment.
I think that sounds smart. John, what's your advice for Team Baker on how to deal with this little kerfuffle, all these tears?
Yeah, the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. I think, you know, this is turned into a story within a story, because maybe he was from Stoughton. Maybe the kids didn't have football scholarships. Maybe they were wrestling scholarships. This is getting fuzzier and fuzzier as we go along. I think that this has been a terrible development for Martha Coakley, because I think that it's a major distraction. I don't think anybody is going to vote on whether Charlie Baker cried or not. And by the way, on the radio, this was excruciating to listen to.
I agree.
It was amazing. So I don't think that's going to matter. I think, you know, the problem is that this is a huge distraction, and Martha Coakley's not talking about the things she needs to talk about. The Globe poll that came out today, which I'm going to editorialize and say I think it's too close to the election for that poll. But anyway, the Globe poll said that Martha Coakley only has support of 71% of Democrats, while Charlie Baker has support of 91% of Republicans. So I think that, you know, that's the problem. And the more people talk about this, the less they're talking about the race itself, policy itself, the things that are actually going to matter.
In terms of the polls themselves, which, you know, have been bouncing around, as we mentioned, some show Baker with what appears to be a considerable lead, many within the margin of error. I'm wondering how much stock the two of you even place in polls, knowing what we know about the difficulty of capturing younger voters, voters with cell phones. Tom Keene, how much stock do you place in them?
So I tend to place a lot of stock in polls, and I understand things are fluid, but there's a real science there, and I kind of buy off on the science. I recognize you can push at sampling and, you know, in terms of what the likely voters and so on. But I do put a lot of stock in polls. I put so much stock in polls that I really agree with John here, which is that I think polls can start to become the movers of an election themselves. Mm-hmm. And which is why I too would love not to see the horse race polls in the last couple of weeks.
And John, that's your same hesitation or reservation about seeing them?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this can discourage voters from going out. I mean, you look at the Globe piece today, and all due respect to the Globe, they let the pollster say things that basically shut this race down. And I think it's too close. The media should not be playing that role. I think polls work when you look at trends. I think, you know, snapshots don't necessarily reflect the race, but if you look at the trends, I think that polls can be more reliable from that standpoint.
And John Carroll, you're someone who follows campaigns closely and how candidates work. And what do you think Martha Coakley could do at this point, given that Baker seems to have momentum, given that these next few days do require some delicacy since much of the attention is on Menino? What does she do as a candidate?
It's really difficult, and Tom Menino's death makes it a real high wire act. But I think that Martha Coakley has to stop being so careful. Martha Coakley is a supremely careful candidate, and it's her hallmark. And I think that many times when a race seems lost, the candidate, the true good candidate, the effective candidate, comes out too late. And I think that in this case, she's got a little window of opportunity here to change perception. And I think she should be bold. I think she should be adventurous. I think she should be unafraid.
All right, let's move on and talk about the Ebola story. There was a development today. A judge in Maine rejected a bid by the state to enforce a full quarantine on nurse Casey Hickox. Hickox, of course, returned to the U.S. recently. She was in New Jersey for a while after treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone. Then she went back home to Maine. And she's argued all along that the quarantine order was unnecessary and illegal.
When we let stigmatization win, we all lose. So I think this is something we have to fight from the beginning. I have been told that if friends come to my house, they can't hug me. They have to stay 3 feet away from me.
Now, we just heard from Deborah Wilson, a nurse out in Lenox, delivering much the same message. Tom, I'll start with you. I mean, it does seem amazing that thousands of people dying in Africa, and there's, I don't know if panic's the right word, but heightened concern about Ebola here in America, where one person has died of the disease. What do you make of that?
Well, you know the internet meme that's out there, right? More Americans have married Kim Kardashian than died of Ebola.
But... yeah, right.
So look, unfortunately, this is a politicians know best issue, right? I mean, politicians know more than climate scientists, so I guess we shouldn't be surprised that they also know more than medical doctors. And that really does seem to be the case here. And I have watched this, that it has been more fed by politicians who kind of look to try to grandstand on this. A little bit of it is certainly an anti-Obama thing or an anti, you know, federal government thing. So see how incompetent these people are. But I really do think that the nurse is right in this case. And I applaud the judge for making the decision that was made, because we have gone insane over this issue.
You know, John, it's Tom brings up this point about politician, and it's you can't not notice that this is all happening in an election season. The New York Times points out that many of the toughest state policies are in places where the governors are in the closest races. Maine Governor Paul LePage, one of those, and he says he's even canceling campaign events to monitor the Casey Hickox situation full time.
Yeah, I heard he got a brand new thermometer, so he's all set from that standpoint. This is a classic case of the tug of war between civil liberties and public safety, and politicians are taking advantage of that to sort of tilt the balance. And I think we've seen this in other situations, certainly after 9/11. I think that this is one of those areas where politicians see an advantage to themselves, whether it's an election year or not. And you know what? It's always an election around the corner. So there was no way this wouldn't be a sort of a political football, but I think that that common sense lands you on the right side of this issue. Mm.
John and Tom, we end our Week in Review each week with what we call our hubbubs, those stories that may not have been out there on the front page, but they caught your eye somewhere. John, tell us what yours is this week.
Okay, my hubbub is about two Boston landmarks which are exiting the scene and got appropriate send-offs in the appropriate local dailies. So Hammersley's Bistro down the South End is shutting down, or has shut down, after 27 years. David Mugar, the Boston Macher, he takes out a quarter-page ad in the Boston Globe, very elegant, very nice, to Gordon and Fiona Hammersley, saluting them, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, Daisy Buchanan's on Newbury Street is about to shut down
the other
as
end of the
well
spectrum
next
yeah
week. And what was the send-off for Daisy Buchanan? Someone stole the Daisy sign off the Fairfield street side of the bar. That was reported by the Inside Track in the Boston Herald. So...
perfect, a fitting send-off for each of them.
Perfect placement.
Exactly. And Tom Keene, your hubbub.
All right, so my hubbub is, and I don't know if you've been following it, but in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, voters are probably going to legalize marijuana, which makes it, I think, the third jurisdiction in the nation will now have recreational use of marijuana is permitted. And I am just thinking this is going to be very salutary for our national politics, because I think that congressmen who share a bong at night are not going to filibuster during the day. I also think that all of these members of Congress who try to go back to their districts as much as they can may now start spending more time in Washington, D.C., perhaps just eating Doritos and hanging out with their fellow members of Congress and getting something done.
This might be just in time for Bill Clinton to return, too.
Anthony, your hubbub.
All right, here's mine. It's about South Carolina. So it's not really a local hubbub, but just thinking about things politicians say and the brouhaha that comes out of it. So in South Carolina, Senator Lindsey Graham, he's running for re-election against a Democratic opponent. He's expected to win easily, by the way. But still, one wonders why he would say what he said, even though he says he was joking. So he was at an all-male club in Charleston earlier this month, and after using a profanity to basically say the government is a mess, he said, "If I get to be president, white men who are in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency. I don't know. So now I'm going to sort of come to the defense of the Graham campaign in the sense that they quickly said he was joking. The event was in the spirit of a roast. I get it. I'm sure that's true. But I'm sort of struck by two ideas, that a joke like that still gets a laugh, which I think is kind of weird, and that a modern politician thinks he can make it and believe that no one is going to record it and not spank him for it. So anyway, there's my hubbub.
Maybe he got a jump on that marijuana thing down in D.C.
That could be.
All right, my hubbub has a somber context to it, but it's a good thing in the end, which is that I say this as someone who both bicycles for exercise and I usually bike to work because the traffic is so horrific from where I live to my workplace. But any bicyclist can tell you that biking alongside a truck or a bus is quite frightening. You know, you don't know when they're going to pull over. You don't know if they see you. And just this week, the Boston City Council unanimously passed legislation, which is the first of its kind in the country, that requires city-contracted vehicles to install protective barriers on the trucks. And so basically, in fact, they had an accident recently in the South End in which a city-owned trash truck, as it was taking a right-hand turn, hit a bicyclist. The bicyclist survived. They think it was due to that side protective barrier.
So they just sort of bounce off of the side of the truck?
Basically, I think you can't fall under the wheels. Yeah. So I don't know how many city-owned trucks fall in that category, so I can't say what the impact is. But City Councilor Ayanna Pressley is now calling on private companies operating large trucks to have those barriers. So a good thing as Boston transitions to trying to be a more bicycle-friendly city.
Yes, may that transition come quickly.
That's right, because Anthony, you frequently bike into work as well?
I do, yes.
So good for both
and
of us.
And it can be hell out there.
Just be careful, guys.
We will. Thanks both of you for coming in. Tom Keene is a former Boston City Councilor. He's also a columnist for the Boston Globe. And John Carroll is a professor of communication at Boston University, and he is the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog. Tom and John, thank you.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up is emancipation from the cable companies finally upon us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.